This is Mark Strassman, a reporter for Utopia Media's Cluster Workstation World, which is premiering at this very second. Our first guest, is Colin Hunter, who's the president and CEO of Orion Multisystems, based in Santa Clara, California. Orion yesterday announced its new Orion Cluster Workstations, which will exist in two models. One's a desktop, the other's a desk side. Welcome to Utopia Media's Cluster Workstation World.
Thank you, Mark.
Where do cluster workstations fit into the evolution of computing generally and supercomputing in particular?
Well, I think it represents the transition of what has hitherto been a supercomputer backroom data center style technology, namely clustering, out into the broader world of computers for individuals. It's a world that is that in the past was dominated by what were called technical workstations from companies like Sun Microsystems and Apollo in the old days, IBM, HP. But that market kind of went into eclipse in the late 90s as the PC caught up in performance. But now with our products, we're bringing the much higher performance that clusters enable to that workstation world.
Okay, in fact, that was sort of like what PCs did to workstations is what mini computers a long time ago did to mainframes.
Exactly right. Or in many ways, the whole idea of there's kind of a tension that goes back and forth as technologies, some kinds of technologies come up from below, like PCs did, and kind of cannibalize the workstation market. Other technologies kind of come down from below as they become more cheaper, more cost-effective. For example, windowing systems and high-performance graphics started off at the high end, only available on expensive workstations, but now are ubiquitous at the low end. So there is a kind of back and forth there.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about that, a little more about that in a second or two, but there was a custom research note, a report written by Stacy Quant from the Robert Francis Group, consulting group, that calls cluster workstations, which is what we're talking about here, a disruptive technology. What's it going to be disrupting?
I think it's going to be disrupting two things. One is what might be called what has become a kind of commodity world of desktop computing, where there haven't been real radical performance changes, and the people have kind of settled down to a very slow improvement in performance. It kind of disrupts that by bringing an order of magnitude performance improvement right to the desktop. The other is the world of high performance computing, where to date all the focus has been on backroom data center style machines that are, you know, managed by guys in white coats basically, and shared through very awkward kind of clumsy sharing systems. Brings the sort of the light of the personal computer to that world of high performance computing.
Well, again, if we can sort of delve into history a little bit, in the old days, in fact, when I started computing, we would take our punch cards to the cathedral of the mainframes, where they'd be processed in batches and then returned to us as printouts.
When they got around to it.
Yeah. And in fact, after 35 years later, things had sort of migrated back to that model again with these data center clusters, hadn't they?
Yes, that's an extremely good analogy. In many ways, the way people interact now with cluster-style supercomputers is very reminiscent of the 50s and 60s in interactions with mainframes. Once again, you submit your job, and then you wait until your job finally runs, then you get the results back. This is pretty difficult to do fast turnaround software development or any kind of interactive use with a sharing system like that.
And in fact, if I could beat the analogy with a dead horse, sort of, it was at the University of California at Berkeley where these very punch cards became the origin of the slogan "Do not spindle, fold, spindle, or mutilate." And now an example is given in the San Jose Mercury article of a professor at UC Berkeley who's essentially unhappy that he has to wait in line. Even though the cards are gone, he still has to wait in line to get his work done.
Yeah, no, there's no question that computer users want to have their own computers.
Okay, which was, of course, the biggest lesson of the PC revolution.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay, say a little bit more about the details of the technical, administrative, and cost dynamics of the current data center cluster configuration approach that will make their supplementation or replacement by cluster workstations a compelling proposition.
You know, I'm not sure that replacement is the right word.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Supplement is a better one because
right.
Even our cluster workstations only go up to about 100 nodes, and if you have the money, you can. There are out there in the world 1,000 node clusters at places like Lawrence Livermore, and even smaller installations are still hundreds and hundreds of nodes. I think the word supplement really covers it, especially for software developers. In other words, right now, the same cluster has to be used for developing cluster applications and also for running the applications on real data sets to get real work done. And the problem with software development is it's kind of an interactive, bug-prone task that often brings down the computer. And this is a big problem when you bring down the cluster that is also going to be used by somebody else to get their work done. So I think what we'll see is that software development for clusters will migrate basically 100% over to cluster workstations. And then some significant fraction of actual deployed at work will move to workstations because you can get the work done at your pace quickly without having to wait in line. But there'll still be the role for the big backroom machines, the big iron, to run long runs that where the program has been debugged, the data is pretty thoroughly scrubbed, and you're ready to do a very long run using hundreds and hundreds of nodes. This utilization will continue, and it'll be a lot more efficient because we've offloaded the other use.
Exactly. That's a very compelling scenario. For essentially, earthquake people at USGS and weather people at NOAA will be able to work out the algorithms that they're going to use in the big system on their own desks.
Yeah, exactly. And then when the time comes to do an actual weather run or a climate modeling run, then they'll have the whole cluster to themselves.
Okay. Say just a little bit more about this cycle of sort of centralization versus decentralization and whether you were consciously aware of that as you were developing the cluster workstation.
It's really true that there's been a kind of back and forth. I think it's because it's hard to really know what causes it, probably just the evolution of different technologies arriving at different paces. But we started off consciously thinking that the workstation had been a good thing. In other words, Ed Kelly, who was the co-founder of Orion with me, had worked for 10 years at Sun Microsystems, dating back to before they IPO'd, and he experienced the advent of the workstation and the real liberation this brought to people who use these kinds of machines. And we had both observed the kind of eclipse of that level of performance being in the hands of individual users, and we kind of wanted to bring it back because we thought it was valuable. And so I think there was a conscious realization that we had that that the need was there, the technology just wasn't there, and we realized that it could be brought to the workstation. I think similar things happen when the cycle goes the other way. People start thinking that the desktop is a too constrained environment. They think, wow, there are all these really innovative ideas that if I had no limits on power or size, I could really go a long way. And you know, when the money is there, people start building exotic technologies, and before you know it, there's a new fancy mainframe that's gotten built, and there will be markets for those things always.
So in a kind of libertarian way, it's a kind of a free market in MIPS, and the market works to arrange it so you can get the most appropriate computing power at the right place.
Yes, I think sometimes the market exhibits cycles in the same way that the economic market exhibits cycles.
Talk about this from a psychological and sort of work environment world. Are there powerful benefits to be gained, do you think, by adding your machines to the mix in terms of the autonomy, not to mention the amount of the reduced amount of time people are going to have to spend plugging things in and unplugging them and debugging them just to get their work done?
Well, I think the big gain will be in efficiency of utilizing the most scarce resource of all, which is people's brains. In other words, if people can, when they're in the middle of a creative effort that they can have the computer under their control, they can get quick results, they don't have to wait around and go get coffee mandatorily because the computer is being shared, I think you'll see a lot more efficient utilization of human beings. People will want, people want, when they get on a creative splurge, they want to go with it. They don't want to have to sit around and be forced to go at a slow pace because the technology is a limitation. I think we kind of free that.
And they could originally do that when they were writing their poems and their books with quills, they had that kind of integrity, and essentially you're trying to give it back to them at a higher level of technology.
Considerably higher, I probably would have gone back to the PC.
Right.
Going back to the quill is it's definitely an earlier technology.
Right, it's the same principle. Say something, if you want, about the architectural or the technical arrangement of what I'm calling legacy clusters, these data center concatenations, and whether you borrowed, rejected, duplicated, modified, and upgraded that architecture and essentially shrank it to put it in the box of your systems.
Well, actually, what's interesting is there has been a convergence on a standard in the data center, and that standard is basically essentially high-performance PCs connected by high-performance communications fabrics like Gigabit Ethernet or some more exotic ones like Mirinet. What we did is we observed that a standard had emerged, a standard at both the hardware level, you know, x86 architecture and Ethernet, say, and also at the software level, Linux and the MPI message passing library had become the default software standards. And so what we did is we took those standards and we said, how can we best put this into a single box in the form of a workstation? And the real key was observing that mobile computing, laptop-based computers, had been wrestling with the problems of power and heat for many years, and there had evolved a class of components, mobile x86 processors, 2.5-inch disk drives, that had gone a long way toward solving these problems. It was largely a matter of bringing ideas that came out of the mobile computing world that enabled us to move clusters into a box.
The greater efficiency, especially in terms of power versus processing capability.
Exactly. Mobile processors are all about performance per watt as opposed to just raw performance. And that's what you need when you're trying to build a workstation.
Which allows you to plug in one cord from your box into the wall and it works.
Exactly. It enables us to have a maximum power on our 96-node system of 1,400 watts or so, which is about like a toaster oven, and it's easily something that can be accommodated by a single wall socket.
Okay, answer the obvious question of why you used these standards instead of developing a proprietary system.
Well, the more proprietary work you do, the more likely you are to get off on a curve that isn't competitive on either a performance improvement basis or on a cost basis. You want to try to take advantage of the march of technology to support existing large markets. You're on declining price curves, you're on increasing performance curves without having to do any real work as long as you stay with standards. If you get off standards, you have to do all the work yourself. So we try to be very sparing about how much we do ourselves. We use standards like Linux, but we focus on maybe making our own drivers that customize the drivers to our underlying hardware. We use x86 architecture, but we build our own motherboard because that's where we can really optimize the performance per watt by running, for example, the Ethernet wires. Instead of having dangling wires, we run traces on the single circuit board. So we're sparing about where we use our proprietary ideas, and as much as possible try to use standards, components, existing materials.
And in fact, you outsource the manufacturer of your systems to Flextronics.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to become a specialist in manufacturing. Flextronics does a great job of that already.
In fact, what you sort of have here is kind of a virtual bakery where you've got the off the shelf ingredients, and your contribution is to figure out how to put them together, and eventually, and also, of course, how to market them.
I would say that our fundamental value added is in the architecture of the system, including the design of the main circuit board, the architecture of the mechanical and thermal design, and then the software. We do a lot of work on the software. We do all the firmware. We do all the stuff that makes a collection of computers behave like a single computer with a single on-off switch. The whole computer comes up in a minute and a half, as opposed to all morning, which would be typical of a backroom style cluster. So there's a lot of effort that has to be done at the software level, but it's within the context of standards.
So in fact, your contribution is to get the symphony the orchestra all playing together.
Exactly, that's a good analogy.
The advantages that you have here of a lot of processing for a little bit of wattage You're using a chip, the Officion. I've never pronounced it. I've never heard it pronounced, but it's Officion, I suppose.
Officion, yes.
Officion from Transmeta.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were a co-founder of Transmeta.
Yes.
And is the use of their chips in your system, is it cronyism, or are the chips just too good not to use?
Actually, I think Ed Kelly and I, who were the founders, he was also a co-founder with me of Transmeta. And I think, if anything, we were a little bit biased against Transmeta because, you know, it always seems like the grass is always greener. When you've been in one place for a long time, you like to look at other alternatives. But we did a pretty thorough evaluation, and it was pretty clear that the Officion was the right choice for our application, which is performance per watt. After our evaluation, we chose them, and we're pretty happy with it.
Okay. On a similar note, Linus Torvald, who created the Linux kernel, worked for a time at Transmeta.
Yes, I brought him from Finland to the United States. He worked for me for about 5 years. I was the software guy at Transmeta.
Oh, okay.
I ran the software group.
Oh, all right. And through the wonder of the internet, I was able to find out that he recently took an indefinite leave of absence to work on a quote high-end data center application or set of them for Linux. Are we seeing the fruition of any or all of this in the Orion multi-systems cluster workstations running Fedora Core 2? Is there any relation there? Any inside story there?
Linus is a friend of the company. He is currently working for the Open Source Development Lab in Portland.
Right.
We have a remote office in the Portland area. We've hired a few people from the OSDL team, and we have a very close relationship with the Linux core people. But Linus doesn't have a formal relationship with Orion.
Say a little. Use that as a way of saying a little bit more about Linux and how important it is to the whole operation.
Linux is one of the key standards. We use Linux as the default OS on the compute nodes. In the typical cluster, there's one head node that is the one that kind of communicates with the outside world. It's where you get your email and launch programs and things like that. And then there's the compute nodes where the cluster applications themselves spend most of their time running on the compute nodes. Linux is the key to the compute nodes. We control this very closely ourselves. The whole OS stack on the compute nodes. On the head node, we're pretty flexible. We supply a Fedora core distro, including all the usual software packages. But if our customer prefers something else, like SUSE or Red Hat Enterprise or one of the other standard distributions, we allow them. We have a DVD drive, a DVD that contains our modifications to make all the compute nodes run on our distribution, so you can simply put your favorite distro on the head node and then use our stuff to modify that. It's kind of a layer on top of it. And conceptually, you could run almost any operating system on the head node, provided we can put our layer to enable all the compute nodes to work. This can be a useful thing because people tend to have the most personal loyalty to, you know, the applications they use for things like email, and we don't want to really interfere with that. But we have to provide a standard platform for the cluster application to run.
Right,
and that's where Linux plus MPI comes in.
Okay, now the questions about the company as such are a little lower down here, but I wanted to ask you this since we may not remember about head nodes and cluster nodes in a minute. Often you can see parallels between the way a company's organized and the technology they're using. Is the organizational structure at Orion kind of are you the head node and their cluster node, or is it more of an egalitarian? How does that work over there?
Actually, we have from an organizational perspective, I think I'm not sure there is such a thing as a typical Silicon Valley startup, but we're,
right.
You know, we have about currently about 45 employees, and a lot of our people have done startups before, and so we have a team that's pretty experienced at this sort of thing. So there's not a lot of explicit hierarchy and direction that we have to give. I'm not sure if that's a cluster model. It's a very interesting analogy. I must keep that in mind the next time we're discussing organizational issues that I will be the head note. I must say, the first time I've ever heard that.
You can use that. Well, this is the first episode of Cluster Workstation World, so it's we're coming up with with new, you know, maybe it is the 80s again.
Or the
90s. Here's a chance to brag. How fast are these machines?
The desktop is a 18 gigaflops device, and the desk side is 150 gigaflops. Just to give you kind of a way of comparing, if you hook together, say, three or four of the desk sides, which you can. I mean, there'd be a power problem because you'd have to have, you know, a wire coming in from the next room or something.
Right.
But if you were able to hook, if you could to get enough power to run, say, three or four of them together, it would be a top 500 supercomputer.
And are they pretty easy to hook up four of them together?
Yeah, they're just, it's you set it up in a ring structure with just some cables.
Right. Okay.
The as I said, you can also hook up to four of the desktops, and that's an easier thing because it'll just stack on your desktop and they can easily plug into the wall. And that would give you 48 nodes. The desk sides, if you were able to get four together, would be almost 400 nodes, which would be a pretty significant cluster.
Now, what you're saying here is reminiscent of something I was reading yesterday as research that hasn't come up lately in any of the newer stuff. You were involved with another company or another product that had these modular computers that hooked up to each other? Was that...
I'm sorry?
Maybe you didn't. There was an article I read yesterday that mentioned that you were involved with some effort to hook up some modular computers.
I've been, since I left Transmeta 3 years ago, I've been on a couple of boards of directors. I was on the board of directors of OQO.
Yes, that was the one. Yes, that was the one.
They had the very small kind of palm-sized computer that ran, that runs, it's still, I mean, it's still going. I mean, it runs Windows XP. I don't really feel like I should really be commenting on that because you know, I'm no longer on the board of directors. I'm a friend of the company, but I just have so much. I don't have any time anymore.
No. There's no need to talk about that. It just seemed somewhat modular in the model of what you were talking about when you got here.
OQO is a fine example. By the way, it's a fine example of the use of compute density in mobility as opposed to what we're trying to do, which is in performance.
Right. Okay. What are the other specs? Is everything just pretty much standard to support all those flops? In terms of hard drives,
that would be double precision LINPACK, by the way, sustained.
Right.
Sustained LINPACK. We have tried really hard to avoid any non-standard components,
right.
So I'm pretty sure that that's an accurate characterization.
Okay. Who's going to want to use these, and what are they going to want to use them for?
Pretty much anybody in what might be called modeling or design, where computing, high-performance computing is a critical issue, you know, like CAD, CAE, mechanical design, electrical design, bioinformatics, rational drug discovery, it's called. There's computational chemistry, geophysics, entertainment, the whole world of special effects, fully digital movies. There's a vast array of scientific applications that they're pretty specialized, but I mean, basically, high-performance computing is undergoing a renaissance right now because of the because as you get into these higher and higher performance levels, you can start doing really amazing things. I mean, movies like Toy Story and A Bug's Life just wouldn't be possible without high-performance computing. Similarly, nobody builds wind tunnels anymore because high-performance computing makes it possible to do all kinds of modeling of airflow and water flow inside the computer.
Nobody explodes hydrogen bombs anymore because they can model those on computers.
And hopefully for other reasons as well.
Treaties. And getting along. One application you didn't mention that I'm not into personally, but I understand it's popular with some other people, is gaming and immersive virtual reality and things like that. I imagine you could get some pretty stunning effects for games if you were using one of these machines instead of a game box.
Yeah, it would depend on the game algorithm. There are some algorithms that are being explored right now that would be a good match for this kind of device. A lot of the conventional video games are optimized for a quick response so they can be real time,
right,
but not exactly photorealistic imagery. And our computer is optimized kind of for the other thing.
Right.
In other words, so we're more for Hollywood style digital video than we are for kind of first person shooter video games. But I mean, conceptually speaking, you could write some pretty fancy games if you can do photorealistic images.
And in fact, if you hooked up whatever has been developed already for the fast response with your engine to do the rendering of the images, you could get
It could be very interesting. That's true. I hadn't thought of that. That would be a possible application, although you'd have to be a pretty devoted gamer to be willing to buy a 96-node workstation to run your video games.
Right, or you could put them in what they, I think, used to call video arcades.
Oh, yeah, that's a possibility. It could be in a really fancy arcade.
And the kids growing up now could grow up with those, and they think what we've got now is like Pong, you know?
Yeah, so. Exactly. That's a good point.
Okay. I got a press release today from another part of what I'm doing here, from the National Institutes of Health, about the establishment of what they call the Fifth Center of Excellence in Complex Biomedical Systems Research. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be called the Center for Quantitative Biology.
Wonderful. I hope they buy a lot of our work.
That's exactly right. I asked if they'd be using stem cells and getting into controversies, and they said they'd be modeling them on computers, so no stem cells would be harmed in the discovery of this biological principle.
Yeah,
is that the kind of work your systems would excel at?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, everybody, I think, agrees that that biology and medical technology in general is going to be the big customer for computers over the next 10 or 20 years, not just our kind of computers, but pretty much anything, because there's really essentially no limit to the demands for computing cycles that modeling living things imposes. Just let me give you one example. Right now, the real cutting edge of computer modeling in the biospace is trying to model the behavior of, say, 100,000 atoms moving in a solution with water and a protein, and watch the protein fold.
What's protein fold? What's protein
is enough to model a protein.
What's a protein fold? What's protein folding?
Protein folding is the is trying to discover how a string of amino acids produced by a single gene will fold up into a three-dimensional shape that can do the job of an enzyme and actually make some biologically significant action, like you know, working inside the cell in some chemical reaction.
So if the amino acids are the Lego blocks, this is a way of modeling how you can put them together and how they shape themselves before they form something with biological meaning.
Exactly right, and it's a very difficult computational challenge. And the way it's done right now, using molecular dynamics, is you model the actual behavior of these atoms, including the water molecules, and you trace their evolution as they interact via the forces, the atomic level forces, the electrostatic and chemical forces. And the way you do it is by dividing it into little time steps. And each time step is one femtosecond. That means there are femtoseconds go to picoseconds, and then picoseconds go to nanoseconds. There are a million femtoseconds in a nanosecond. Now, it turns out that the significant barrier to being able to compute a full protein fold is about a microsecond. That's 1 billion femtoseconds. So the challenge of modeling 100,000 atoms moving in femtosecond steps for a microsecond is just beyond the capability of the fastest clusters in the big Livermore-style data centers. That's one protein. A cell is, 1,000 times the size of a protein in every direction, which means it's 1 billion times the volume, and a microsecond is a very small fraction of a living thing's life. So doing true atomic-scale modeling of living things is something that's going to be just about achievable sometime about the year 2050, at the rate computers are growing. So I think that the biological sciences will be consumers of computers for as long as I'm involved in it.
Well, so as long as there's the curiosity and the funding.
Yeah, well, I think as long as people want to live longer, they'll still want to buy drives.
Right, and they'll still need this system to figure out how to make them work.
Yes, that's
all right. That's an interesting concept. Say something about from your point of view, about how the deployment of these systems, the effect it'll have on IT management, on workplace collaboration, on cost structures, and the speed up of computing work.
Well, we fit into what might be called standard models of managing computers. There's a buzzword called grid that everybody uses a lot, which we're in favor of too.
There's a grid world right next to your next door neighbor here on my website.
Yes, well, grid is a way of trying to effectively manage a bunch of distributed computing resources in such a way that they can be you know, if you have unused cycles over here, you can make use of them over here. And
no cycle left behind.
Yes, and one of the ways you accomplish this is by running a piece of grid software on your computer.
Right.
And we support those grid clients ourselves, so that means that our unused cycles can be shared as part of a big grid. And we know these are all good ideas, and we support them. And we think that centralized administration of resources like this makes a lot of sense, provided the final word on whether I'm going to share at all belongs with the actual user of the box.
Right. That essentially, you can loan someone your lawnmower, but only with your permission. They can't come and take it out of the garage. For that.
Yeah, that's the key issue with most users of high performance computing.
But
they
want to make sure
they can get their computer when they need it.
Right. But in fact, your systems are optimized in both directions, so that they're under the control of the individual user, but they're grid ready.
Exactly.
And can be added to other people's computing power if necessary. What do you know about that? What's been done with that internally in your company or elsewhere about using these to build grids? Has there been a lot of interest in that?
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of interest in grid. The real difficulty is that there haven't been a lot of standards that have emerged. There have been a few attempts, but so far, people who have grid systems are all doing it a little bit differently. So
really? I interviewed Charlie Catlett, who's head of the Global Grid Forum. I interviewed the person who's head of the Enterprise Grid Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
They even were talking about cooperating with each other. You're saying that the pictures they painted of everybody getting together is not really what happens on the ground?
I think people do want to get together. I mean, I just observed that when I go to different companies, they seem to all have different grid solutions.
Okay.
I would hope that some common standard can emerge, because then we'll support it.
Right.
What I've seen is a lot of interest in grid, and people are using and deploying grids, but they tend to be, each one has a kind of a different flavor.
Okay.
But, I mean, I could be, I don't have a lot of direct experience with the attempts being made to unify and create standards, and I assume there are efforts along that path.
Okay. How big a market do you expect there'll be for your product here?
It's difficult to say. IDC estimated that the high-performance computing market in our price range, you know, $10,000 to $100,000, $150,000, is a pretty big market, about $2.5 billion this year, and growing at a pretty rapid clip. And that the bioinformatics space by itself will be about that big in 2007. So, although it, a couple of $3 billion may look small to IBM, we kind of like it.
All right. Speaking of getting those billions, how soon do you expect to face competition in the space that you're creating with these products?
It's difficult to say. I think we'll have a bit of a lead. We're definitely first in the market, and I think we'll have a lead for a while. It usually takes a while for large institutions like the existing computer companies to notice some new phenomenon and then react to it, and they typically react using their proprietary solutions, and so I think we'll have a year or two, maybe even more, before we face significant competition.
Okay, is Orion Multisystems privately held or publicly traded?
We're private.
Okay, and you mentioned already you have about 45 employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, say a little bit about the role your venture capitalist backers played in the development of the company.
Our lead venture capitalist is Battery Ventures, out of Boston. They have a West Coast office also, and Battery has been a good partner of ours. We're pleased with the help they've given us in introducing us to a few key accounts, also in, of course, providing the money.
Right.
So, yeah, we have a good relationship with Battery. Listen, Mark, I'm going to have to sort of break this off. I hope this has been helpful.
It is. There's only one question left.
Oh, great.
Actually, two.
Fire away.
First, there was Google's semi-wildly successful IPO. Now you're creating a computer hardware company. Are the 80s back or the 90s, or what's happening here?
I think that there has been a resurgence in the valley in the beginning of this year. I've definitely observed in my discussions with venture capitalists that this year there's been a lot more activity, that the offices that last year were kind of empty are now full of eager entrepreneurs trying to raise money. So I think I think we're seeing the beginning of a resurgence in the valley.
Of course, a lot of them will need your systems to do their work.
I sure hope.
Finally, do you have a cluster workstation on or beside your desk?
Actually, I have one to the left of my desk, over at the person right next to me, because my personal utilization of computers is primarily to send email, but the person immediately to my left actually uses it for real work.
Okay, so you're almost eating your own dog food there.
Oh, yes. We are the largest consumer of Orion workstations.
Okay. Well, maybe not for long. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on the first episode of Utopia Media's Cluster Workstation World. Hopefully there'll be a lot more of this to go around.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Bye.